Welcome to the Indi Candidates Forum on Our Voice, Politics or Brugadonga. And I'm your host, Ben Habib. The current guest is Labor Party candidate Javella Leshin. I caught up with Javella earlier at her home in beautiful Buffalo River. Okay, Javella Leshin, welcome to the Indi Candidates Forum podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start off by talking about some electorate-specific stuff and local issues. What are some of the strengths that you could bring to Parliament as a newly elected member for Indi?
I think one of my greatest strengths is that I'm very good at taking individual problems and coming up with policy solutions for them. I have been involved for a very long time with policy writing with the Labor Party for well over 14 years, and for the last 5 years I've been president of the Country Labor Executive, which writes rural and regional policy for the Labor Party in Victoria. So I'm very much aware of country issues, but I'm also very good at taking problems and finding solutions, taking them through the policy process. My philosophy about politics is if you want to do good in your community, you can help individuals one person at a time, or you can work out what the problem is, how to solve it, and that way you fix the problem for people that you don't even know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In your opinion, what are some of the most pressing problems faced by communities in this electorate? And as the local member, what would you be doing to fix them or address them?
As you know, Ben, it's a very broad and very diverse electorate in many ways. And that means that each town and each area has its own burning issues. As a long-time door knocker, I can say each household has its own burning issues, and they're not necessarily the same. But I think we're all linked by water. We are one of the big water-producing areas for the nation. That gives us responsibilities in terms of how we manage water and the water quality and so on. It also causes us great problems around water security, and it's very hard to be on water restrictions and watch the river fly by to other communities, although I know people understand that. So water is always contentious up here, and water security for towns, water security for farmers, and just how water is managed are all big issues here. And that feeds into climate change as well, which from my work on the ground, I know that many farmers are concerned about, as well as other people in the electorate. But for farmers particularly, it's having real impacts on the way they do business and the way they manage their farms and their livestock and their crops. And so, they recognise, they might not necessarily be able to say, yes, I believe it's man-made, but they recognise that climate change is an issue. They recognise that they need to adapt, and they need assistance in adapting.
Okay, one of my students wrote me an angry email recently because he's just discovered that country people have it very different to our city cousins. And obviously it's no surprise to anyone living in a rural or regional community that this disparity exists. Why do you think this continues to be the case? And how do the communities in Indi fit into the Labor Party's vision for regional Australia?
Well, first of all, I'd say, let's look at the positives. Yes, there are difficulties living in country areas with access to services, and there always will be. That's just a fact of life. But we still all are living here, and the reason we're all living here is that we recognise that we've got benefits that the city people will never have access to. We have real communities. I can leave my kids run wild, if you like, at the local show, because I know that they're not going to get into trouble. If they do, someone in the community is going, oh, hang on, that's one of the Leshin boys, what's going on there? I know that, and I shouldn't say this because the police get very cross with you, I know I can leave my car unlocked in the main street because no one's going to tamper with my stuff. And if they do, someone will go, hang on, what's that person doing at Chevella's car? So we've got that sense of community that people in the city don't have and really would love to have. We've got a wonderful environment, particularly in the northeast. So let's not be too negative about this. We do have benefits the city people will never have, and we need to look at the glass half full thing as well. Look, when we get to services, it's simply a case of population and population spread. You're never ever going to have an ideal world where the remotest person living in Australia has got a full range of services available to them as the person in the city has. I have to say this is where the NBN plan will help a lot, because it will make many of those services accessible through computers and therefore accessible to every home. So hopefully you know, and these technologies are only starting to be developed, so we don't know where they lead. But hopefully a lot of things at the moment you have to drive to the city to access, you'll be able to access at the click of a button. So the NBN is obviously a really big part of how we're going to improve services in country areas, because we'll make things a lot more accessible.
Yep. Okay, if I'm a young person living somewhere in the electorate, what Labor Party policies are going to benefit me if the ALP's return to government? And how would you advocate for young people in Indi?
Well, I think I've touched on it with the NBN and also with climate change, because young people are the people who are going to be growing up in this area and dealing with the consequences of an environment which is under stress. So, and I think young people understand that. Obviously, we've done a lot of work in education, which we'll continue to do, although that's probably a younger age group than you're looking at. So there's an ongoing focus in education on training young people and providing them with educational opportunities. The revamp of the youth allowance was aimed specifically to get more country kids to go to university and to be, you know, to be able to afford to do that without doing a gap year, which tends to divert them and means that they lose focus. So part of the thinking behind the youth allowance was, if we get them to go straight from high school to university, we make it easier for country kids to do that, and there's a lot of benefits for country kids in that package. We'll see more country kids going to university and completing their degree. And I think that the statistics are already showing that that's happening, that we're getting, you know, small improvement, but it's an improvement in the number of kids from rural and regional Victoria who are going on to university education. So, I think in other areas, young people tend to be more idealistic, which is always difficult when you're trying to explain to them the practicals of politics. But, I mean, we genuinely have got a policy on refugees, however flawed people may think it is, which does do what refugee advocate groups have been asking us to do. And I, you know, if people don't believe that, I recommend that they look at what the refugee advocates are saying, because they're saying we don't want people getting into the leaky boats to cross the ocean. We want them to be processed regionally. We are taking action on the environment. Again, it's not getting through in the mainstream media, but Labor's got an awful lot of policies in action at the moment to tackle climate change. We can't go as far as we like because of the Senate, but that's life. So, you know, the NBN, all that. As for how I connect with young people, I'm a secondary school teacher of many years' experience. I have ongoing, very warm friendships with a lot of my ex-students. I get young people and I relate well to them. So I know that I'll have no difficulty getting young people to talk to me about the areas of concern. One of the things I've always wanted to do locally, and most local councils are doing it on a micro level of having youth councils, and I've always thought it'd be great to get together, you know, a group, a bit like Julia's set, you know, jury thing, get together a group of young people from throughout the region for a couple of days workshopping about where do you want this region to go. But just to recap, you know, NBN, climate change and ongoing work, education and training, these are all things that the Labor Party is focusing on for young people, and they're all things that have real benefits for kids in Indi.
Okay, great. Well, let's move on now to the state of political debate in this country at the moment. I guess one of the most irritating things about the political discourse in this country in recent years has been the reduction of the debate to short sound bites, image branding and a lot of PR slogans. In your opinion, why is this style of discourse necessary in politics, given that all sides seem to engage in it?
It's necessary, and I'm going to dispute a bit of that in a minute. It's necessary because of the way the mainstream media operates. And I do it all the time. I'll drive all the way up to Wodonga, which is an hour from here. I'll stand in front of a TV camera for 20 minutes and I'll get back in the car and I'll drive back home again. And if I'm lucky, 30 seconds of that will get on television. Still worth doing because you've got to get the message out. What is changing, however, is things exactly like this, that especially with young people, they're accessing things through the computer. They're accessing things through you know, Scott, up through APAC, where you can watch the whole of a media interview and you can see how the information is then manipulated. So the mainstream media, as you can understand, is getting very edgy about this. They're getting very edgy about a lot of the blog sites which discuss politics, which take apart every word in a media release rather than just grabbing a 30-second bite out of it and then running with it. So I actually think political discourse is improving. I think it's diversifying, and I think that that's going to be an ongoing process, and that is very good for democracy because it means that instead of going through the filter of a journalist, you can watch a media conference live, you can watch it on record, you can then make your own judgments about what that politician is saying and, you know, how they present that. So I certainly still find it very frustrating the way information is manipulated. It would be great if the 30-second grab was an honest grab. Often it's not. And there's a lot of good stuff that particularly this government's been doing that out there in populist land, people think are failed projects because they've taken the media message because they don't have access yet to all of that wide range of technologies. Again, the NBN, all of that will be a lot easier. People will be able to, you know, as I say, watch these things at their own leisure, make their own judgments about what the politician is saying. And I can see that going further. I can see that going to a more hands-on approach to politics where some of the parties are doing it now where they have blogs where they invite comment where people can feed in. And that's going to become more and more a part of the electoral process.
I think you've touched on the exact purpose of this blog and this podcast series. Mm-hmm. That's good. Okay, there's been a trend in other two-party Western democracies like Britain and the US of a shift away from major parties towards alternative political forces, which spring in part possibly from a dissatisfaction with some of this superficial politics. Do you think a similar trend is possible here in Australia, with the Coalition and the ALP leaking support to alternative parties or independents?
Look, you could ask this question almost any time. Sorry, Nikki, can you get that? You could ask this question almost any time in the last 50 years. We have small independence parties. We have independent people all the time putting their name forward to Parliament. Some of them, like One Nation, get a bit of wind behind them for a time. Australian Democrats, was a force in politics for a long time. They tend to fade away. And the reason that they tend to fade away is that most people recognise that mainstream politics is like that for a reason. They're appealing to the bulk of the population and they're taking the concerns of the bulk of the population seriously. That it's a realistic approach to life and, yes, you can dream, as I often do, about some, far-left ideas, and indeed, no, I don't think about too much far-right ideas, and as others do about far-right ideas, but it's politics is the art of the possible, and I think ultimately people recognise that. On the other hand, obviously independents and small parties are good for democracy. They get the conversation going. They ask questions that the majors don't want to ask or don't want to answer. And that's obviously a good thing to happen. But I really realistically can't see a third party maintaining its integrity and becoming a force. You have to compromise in politics. And I think if you look at the small parties overseas that have gone mainstream, they've shifted an awful long way from where they started as far as their stance and ideologies go, because they have to.
Mm-hmm. All right, you've touched on climate change a couple of times in your answers so far, but let's look at it in some more detail now. What's your personal position on the climate change debate?
I'm very lucky. One of my friends is actually one of the top climate change scientists in Australia and probably the world. She's on the IPCC. She was invited by George Bush to be his climate change advisor and very politely declined.
And what's her name?
Professor Amanda Lynch.
Amanda Lynch.
And it's been really good because I start off everything from a very sceptical point of view. I ask the questions that are out there to people who know, to the experts. And I did that with Amanda. I said, okay, is this true, is this true, is this true? And I threw a whole lot of questions at her, and she was able to deal with them in a way that I felt comfortable with, and I've moved on from there. So as you can see, this house is very much designed around climate change principles, around, reducing emissions. We haven't got round to solar because so far we haven't needed it. The problem is the place is too hot. but with Professor Lynch, I was an Alpine Shire councillor when she came back to Australia, and she was brought back to Australia as one of the sort of emeritus people that had gone overseas that they wanted to bring back. I forget the name of the program. And she was one of the first to be brought back under that program. And what she'd been doing in America was to go to communities and work from the ground up, sit down with them and say, okay, how is climate change likely to affect your lives? You know, what can you see happening in the world around you as far as climate goes? You know, what changes are you having to make? What do you need help? What do you want to know more of? And then her research then takes those questions or takes those answers and investigates them further. So it's the community asking the questions and the community then directing the research. Now, the reason I came on board because this area had gone through some rather extreme events. In fact, for a while we were regarded as the disaster capital of Australia. And she looked at it from the point of view of climate change scientists and said this is exactly the sort of scenario you'd expect as a result of climate change, the extreme events following one another very quickly, and that therefore made this a good community for her to start her research. And also she knew that I was here and I could feed into the community for her. So my role was to set up interviews for her. So she'd say, I would like to talk to a cattle farmer. I want to talk to someone who's growing tobacco. I want to talk to someone who's dairying. I want to talk to someone in the pine plantation industry. And I'd make all those connections. And the good thing was that I got to sit in then on the interviews and also have a squiz at the research. So project sort of unfortunately ended before we would have liked it to, just funding. But what it meant was that I was sitting in the lounge rooms of stakeholders in the region listening to their stories, and particularly people that had, you know, families here for 100 or years or more. And they all acknowledged that the climate was changing. They all acknowledged that they were changing the way they were farming or the way they were doing business because the climate was changing, and that it was unprecedented change, that it wasn't something that their grandfathers had seen or their great-grandfathers had seen. So I think there's, you know, I think I said before, I don't think they're all putting their hand up saying this is what's causing it, but I think the recognition that there's a problem is out there. Yes, so I've had that hands-on involvement with climate change, with talking to the community about it, with listening to their concerns, and also the very fortunate position of actually being able to ask the experts some of the thorny questions, and even, I have to say, directing some of the research myself by asking a few questions about what was happening locally and what that meant.
Okay. It's been well documented that one of the primary reasons Kevin Rudd's dramatic fall in popular support earlier in the year was the delay of the CPRS legislation. Now, the CPRS itself was seen as flawed policy in some quarters when its intended outcomes were compared with the carbon cuts that are deemed necessary by the latest scientific evidence. And all of this came after Kevin Rudd used such apocalyptic language to describe the climate change threat both at home and abroad. In your opinion, what does the ALP have to do to restore some credibility on this issue?
Well, I think what the premise of your question points to the difficulty that we're having with the Senate and particularly with the Liberal parties, that even a bill that had been compromised with to suit what the Liberal Party said that they wanted was a bill which probably made much smaller steps than those of us concerned with climate change would have liked, was still not compromised enough for the Liberal Party to be able to accept it. So the reality of the situation is we have a Senate which the majority of do not want to take action on climate change. And we have that Senate regardless of the election outcome for the next year. Mm-hmm. So realistically, Labor's doing all it can within those constraints. It's investing a huge amount of money into research and into practical on-the-ground applications of emissions reduction, such as alternative technologies, which is probably as far as they can go at present, given that they can't go to the ideal, which is some kind of price on carbon. Now, we'll get there because every expert in the world, every economist in the world who looks at the issue seriously comes out and says you need an emissions trading scheme of some kind. So we'll get there, but we realistically won't get there within the next year. So what we're doing within that year is using that period to build consensus, to get the debate out there and happening. We know because people, when they're confronted by the facts, always come back to we need a price on carbon. and usually come back to, and an ETS is the way to go. So we're pretty confident that going through that process of consulting with the community through this this group of people, and I would expect that every bit of information they are given is given to the community as a whole, because the media is like that, will build the realisation in the community of the severity of the problem and what kind of action needs to be taken. And you won't get as much of that negativity out there and that nervousness. So realistically, no point putting legislation up until at least July next year, because it won't go anywhere. So let's use that time to make sure people understand the issue, make sure they understand why the solutions that are being put forward are the ones that need to be adopted. And they, you know, if you've got that groundswell of community support behind you, it's very, very hard for even the most recalcitrant Senate to keep blocking the legislation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If elected, will you work to attract more renewable energy projects to the region?
I certainly would. I'm a great proponent of renewable energy, and I couldn't even say the word sometimes. again, as you can see from the way this house is designed, you know,
very much so.
Yes, we've been aware of the need to, personally, we've been aware of the need for renewable energy to be a major part of the whole energy construct for years. Mm. You know, this is the third house my husband and I have built, and the first one we built back in 1980 was orientated to the north and had big glass windows. So we've been into the passive design stuff for many years. And I love wind farms. I think they look terrific. there's geothermal. I'm not quite sure how much potential there is in this area. For example, in this valley, we don't get any wind at all. But you know, I'm sure there are opportunities out there that we could capitalise on, and I certainly would be supportive.
Yeah. Okay. Now this is a question that I've asked all the candidates verbatim, because I think it's an important one and an idea that needs to enter the wider political debate across the spectrum. So to grow the economy necessarily entails increasing resource consumption and greenhouse gas pollution. So therefore, do you think, given that we live on a finite planet, that perpetual economic growth is possible in the long run?
I'm sceptical about perpetual economic growth, but certainly in the foreseeable future, I think we're looking at economic growth, and I think that it's necessary, because there's an awful lot of communities out there, not necessarily within our country, who do lead pretty awful lives, and one way or another we have to deal with that. And one way of dealing with that is by growing the global economy and creating opportunities for education and so on. Now, the beauty of providing better economic lifestyles across the planet, providing better education, is the better educated people are, the less children they have. So if we are able to, you know, bring all these other countries along with us, bring them, you know, improve their standard of living, give them education, the population should stabilise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really interesting question to deal with too, because, and I suppose part of the sustainable Australia conversation that Julia started, is we don't know what the world population should be, let alone what Australia's population should be. Because for the last 200-300 years, people have kept saying, well-respected economists who've done the research have kept saying to us, we've reached the limits. The Earth cannot take any more population, and yet we manage to increase that population, you know, probably far more than we should, but we're still surviving. So that question of where the cutoff point is very difficult to answer, because it depends a lot on technology, it depends a lot on the way we manage resources. I personally, you know, we live a very frugal lifestyle here, but I still reckon we'd probably throw away enough food in a week to feed two or three other people. So does that mean, you know, if I'm still able to throw away food rather than reuse it, or you know, I think there's still room there for other people to be living here. So it's a difficult question, because we've never ever had an answer that stood up to the test of time as to what a sustainable population of human beings for this planet is. And I was reading a book that a friend of mine loaned me on the other day, that I couldn't get past the first chapter because it was a list of how many times people had said the world planet is doomed, we cannot afford to keep growing the way they're growing, you know, starting with Malthus. And when I got to the guy who was saying in 1940, we can't grow the planet anymore, I thought, well, either we're really, really doomed and there's no point in me reading any of the solutions because we're doomed anyway, or they're all wrong and there's still a bit of room to grow there. I don't think it's a question we can answer at the moment. I think it's one that we need a lot more research on.
No, I think it's a good question to discuss, nonetheless, because it is a complicated one.
As I say, people seem to look at politics and think that, or look at problems and seem to think that you can just come out there and solve it tomorrow by doing this. And when you try to explain to them why this isn't possible, they just put up this block because they want that the idea that problems are easy to solve. If they were easy to solve, they'd have been solved long ago. And the almost every problem has actually got about 500 possible different solutions that you could apply. And each one of those solutions has got pluses and minuses. And the difficulty with policy formulation, as I said, I've done a lot of that, is going through all those different options and working out which one is the least worst. Because anyone you arrive at, people are going to have problems with. And I used to say it about the constitution debate. I said, if you put 14 million Australians in the room and say, write a constitution, they're all going to write something different and they're all going to be equally passionate about what's on that sheet of paper. So then coming to a consensus about what's going to suit everyone is always difficult. So just my message is, it's not as easy as you think, folks.
But it's good. You can't get an answer without asking the questions.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's move on now to the economy. I'll ask a couple of questions about that. The drought and the global financial crisis have hit the Northeast pretty hard over the last few years. What's your vision for renewing the economic vitality of communities in Indi?
Well, to start off with, we've always had it pretty hard up here, I think. We're largely farming communities, and historically we're in one of the lowest income groupings of all electorates. I think at the moment we're the bottom 19th as far as income goes. So we've never been a terrifically wealthy community. There's been wealthy families, when the tobacco, for example, was thriving, there were some very wealthy families here, but their workers weren't particularly wealthy. So I don't think we've ever been a particularly rich area. Now, interestingly, though, we do, for a rural area, have a lot of industry. Now, unfortunately, that's been declining. But it makes sense that if we're an area which is producing products, we should also be an area which is value-adding to those products. And we're doing it a little bit with the TCF industries, with the textile industries in Wangaratta and with some of the rural-based industries in Wodonga. But I think there's a lot more room for that. And because we have got a bit of an industrial base there, we can build on that. We've got the infrastructure, we've got the workforce. So we can certainly, I think, improve in industry. I think there's a big room for boutique, and I'm using the word sort of a bit loosely here, export replacement industries, I suppose. So we've got a lot of olive growers in the area, for example, but we're still importing most of our olive oil. So we've got, because we've got a fairly unique climate here, with the extremes, as you know, on a day like this where you wake up with a frost and it can be minus 5 degrees and by lunchtime it can be 20 degrees plus, we actually can focus on unique products that can only happen here and we can market those. Another thing that as an Alpine Shire councillor I was very passionate about was the whole food and wine thing. Now, I always regard tourism as icing. You need cake and tourism is icing, and if in good times it's great to have icing and in bad times the icing sort of,
it's very dependent industry, isn't it?
It's a very dependent industry and as long as there's that recognition there that you can't always rely on tourism to bring in the dollars, we certainly can build on that. I got approached as often as an Alpine Shire councillor to say, why don't we do, build this attraction here or build that attraction there? And I'd just say, well, because we're not making the best use of what we've got at the moment. Until we're properly marketing what we've got at the moment and getting the best bang for our buck out of what's already there, there's not much point adding to it. So that focus on, and I hate the word exploiting, but that's the best one, but fully exploiting the opportunities we've got here for the tourism market, is important to me, and then building on that. Because once we know how to market these things, once we know how to cater to what visitors want, we can attract more of them. You know, and in this Shire has done, you know, its approach to tourism over the last 10 years has been very good like that. And you can see it, your wife's at Red's at the moment.
Yes.
Now, you know, Red 10 years ago was a little second-hand store. Now he's importing goods and then redistributing all those goods all across Australia. So that's because he recognised the potential of the tourism industry, and he changed the way he was doing business. He used to never be open on weekends. He used to never be open after hours. He realised that if he wanted to take advantage of all of those people who were driving past on the Great Alpine Road, he had to change the way he was doing things. And, you know, you're not going to get a good tourism industry or a growing tourism industry unless individual tourism operators understand that they need to look at their market, they need to look at what people want, and they need to provide that. I'm not saying they're not doing it, but I'm saying there's room for growth there. So there's room for growth as far as industry goes. There's room for growth in agriculture and exploiting some of the advantages of our unique environment. And I think with climate change, we will also be able to take over some of the activities that have been happening in irrigation districts, and I think we should. And there's also room for tourism to grow and create more jobs there.
Okay, now to a broader economic question. International economic instability has been the order of the day for a few years now. The global financial crisis has morphed into the sovereign debt crisis, and at the heart of both issues is debt. So what's your opinion on, A, Australia's level of public debt, and B, on the quite high levels of household and private debt that people are racking up at the moment?
Well, Australia's public debt is the envy of the world. I think we're on 6% and some countries on 160% of GDP. So as far as the country's debt goes, in real terms, we don't have one. You know, people can get all emotional about the amount that we do have, but in real terms, Australia as a country does not have a debt. And it's certainly the 6% or so it has is very, very easily removed. And I just take the caution there. There's no business out there that doesn't have a debt. They recognise that if you're going to grow, you need to invest in infrastructure and in people, and that means that you need to draw on resources that you don't have yet, that you will have in the future. So the country's the same. If we want to invest in our population, in educating them, in providing them with the best infrastructure we can, I can't see any problem in going into debt to do that. If my grandchildren are going to be using the school hall that's being built in Myrtleford at the moment when they go to school, why shouldn't they be contributing to some of the costs of building that hall? They're still, you know, they're using it. So to me, there's no problem with having debt, governments having debt, as long as it's debt that's going to providing infrastructure or community infrastructure such as education, which will benefit us all in the future. And as I say, those future generations shouldn't have a problem with paying a part of that. So Australia's debt, I don't think, is a problem as a country. Private debt does worry me, but that's a case of education as well. And I think with the GFC, a lot of people have come to the realisation that they've got to, you know, take a more cautious attitude to the way that they spend money. And when times are good and, you know, you're employed and house prices are going up every year, so your mortgage is actually looking quite more reasonable every year than it did the year before, it's very easy for people to fool themselves to the idea that, you know, money's an endless stream of things. And so something like the global financial crisis comes along and just reminds us that, no, things can go very badly wrong very quickly, and you need to be prudent about the way you spend money in recognition of that. If you're, you know, if you genuinely have the asset base and the income base to manage your debt, then it's like the country. It really doesn't matter. The question then becomes about, you know, as it does with the country, is are you going into debt for good reasons? And if something goes badly wrong, are you going to be able to manage that debt? But as I say, I think people are coming to those realisations and are being a lot more responsible about the way they're spending their money.
Great. We'll finish up now talking about the asylum seeker issue. Now, given that the Northeast is not all that ethnically diverse in comparison with the capital city, and it's a landlocked electorate, so it doesn't have much to fear from inbound arrivals by sea.
There's the Murray River, you know. It's directly connected to the ocean.
Yeah. So, given those sort of realities, are people in Indi concerned about asylum seekers and boat people and border security? And if they are, why do you think that is?
Well, I had an ALP meeting last night where they were passionately concerned about asylum seekers and border security, but from the more positive, I suppose, aspect of how do we make sure these people are treated humanely and treated well. And I think it's one of those things, you know, the unseen threat is much, much worse than the seen threat. It's much, much easier to convince yourself that that these people are somehow bad or evil or whatever when you don't see them in your community than it is if you do see them in your community and you know that they're not a threat. And it has to be said that, you know, this really shouldn't be an issue for anyone. The number of boat people who are coming in is very small, and they are, by and large, people in genuine need who are genuine refugees. Now, my concern, and this is where I get into trouble with my base, is I don't want them getting on the boats. I don't want people dying to get to Australia. No. You know, if they take that risk and they get here, I'm all for treating them humanely. I'm all for, you know, taking the course that we should as a good international citizen and, you know, taking in people in need. But I really would like to cut out that middle bit of people having to risk their lives in boats. And I think the Regional Processing Centre does go a long way to doing that. I've lost my train. So that to me is a genuine concern. I you know, once they get here, I want them to treat them. Some people sort of say, sort of seem to regard getting in, you know, getting in the boats as your test of your desperation, test of your desire to come to Australia, and therefore we should sort of meet the boat halfway and rescue them and bring them back. And I still, you know, I, if we're going to regard it as an obstacle course, and anyone who, you know, survives the trip here automatically becomes Australian citizen because they've proved their worth. I think we could do it in a much more humane way. We could, you know, slap a little obstacle course on Tiwi Island or something. If they manage to get through it, then at the end we give them an Australian citizenship. I mean, that's the level of silliness I think that that argument has. So I'm after a humane solution. I'm after one that has some consistency to it. A lot of the rhetoric, you have to say, leads to the assumption that we have to take in every single refugee out there, and there's millions of them in the world. So it's balancing those humane considerations with getting people to Australia without them dying, and it's a very, very difficult issue to deal with. It shouldn't be an issue in this electorate, as you say, because they're not turning up on our doors. And I would think that if it was from the humane consideration, because we have taken refugees into this community in the past and we've welcomed them. And, you know, a lot of the Kosovo refugees that Wodonga took a few years ago were only meant to be here for a very short period of time, and the community actually lobbied to have them stay. So we are a welcoming community. We are a community. So I'd like to think that it's not an issue from that point of view, but the issue is, you know, the humanitarian one of how do we treat people fairly and justly.
Okay. Well, how do we have this discussion as a nation about asylum seekers and population and security and related issues in a way that doesn't dredge up some of the worst prejudices that exist in the community?
Look, I think Julie's made a good start on this with her sustainable population discussion, and that's what that's about. As she said, you do have to recognise that people are genuinely fearful, and those fears may be totally, have no basis in reality. But that doesn't mean that they're not real. You know, when you're a kid in a dark room, there aren't monsters under the bed, but that doesn't mean that your fear that there are monsters under the bed isn't a real fear, and that fear needs to be dealt with. And I think we do need to deal with the concerns in the community, even if those concerns seem baseless to those of us who know better or know more about the issue. I'm not going to say that it's based on ignorance. I think there's a lot of deliberate ignorance out there, as in politicians encouraging people to be ignorant because that suits their agendas. I think we need to start the conversation so that people understand what the facts are and understand how they're being manipulated. It's very, very important when there is scaremongering out there, when that we identify it as scaremongering, that we say, this is what people are, this is why people are telling you these things, this is what they're trying to do, and make people aware of the way they are being manipulated. So you, to do that, you have to acknowledge their very real concerns. You have to let them say those concerns without labelling them. So a very interesting one for me was my mother with One Nation, with Pauline Hanson and One Nation. And my mother said, you know, at first I thought it was terrific. I had all of these things that I'd been dying to say for years, and all of a sudden I was allowed to say them. And she said, and then I listened to myself and I thought, what an ugly, mean-spirited person you are. But she needed to say those things. She needed to feel comfortable enough to say them before she could actually hear what it was that she wanted to say. And so I think it's a very good process to go through, to let people say all the things they want to say, even if some of us think that those things are inappropriate, because then you can deal with them. You can't, if the three-year-old, going back to that analogy, if you come in to comfort the three-year-old and he won't tell you that he's scared of monsters under the bed, you've got an impossible task. You know, if you, when he says, I'm scared of the monsters in the bed, start rubbishing the kid for being stupid to believe that there's monsters under the bed, you've lost them.
So do you think that this issue keeps festering in Australian politics because we don't debate it in the way that you're describing?
Yes, I think, yeah, and as I say, I think Julia has made it really clear that that's what she wants to see happen. She wants the facts out there. She wants people talking about the issue so that you can deal with the problem. You know, if people are thinking things but not saying them, then you can't deal with their concerns. If they tell you what their concerns are, then you can deal with it. Something I used to say as a counsellor, I used to say to people, if you don't complain to me, there's no way I can fix the problem. Someone has to tell me there's a problem before I can do something about it. It's the same kind of process. People have to be able to feel that they can say whatever they want to, even if it makes them, as my mother says, it makes them sound nasty and narrow-minded or whatever, because then they can be, you know, the facts can be explained to them. They may then still want to keep on believing what they're believing. That's fine. That's it, right? We're a democracy.
Okay, and to wrap up, what message would you like to leave with the voters of Indi?
Well, politically, just, you know, this is, we're on 9% two-party preferred. That's the best position we've been, Labor Party's been since 1930 when we accidentally won the seat. And so realistically, this means this is our best chance of making it a marginal seat. If we get it to the point, you know, if we shift a couple of percentages, we get to the point where we make everyone nervous about the seat, and that means there'll be more resources thrown at it by the Liberal Party, and therefore it'll, the chances of it swinging back are good. We need to do it now. So if you think that for any reason it's a good idea that Indi become a marginal seat, this is your best chance of doing it. And that means that people have to change their votes from Liberal to Labor. That's the only way it's going to happen. So that is my main message. I think people recognise that there would be real advantages in that happening, and this is the best election to make it happen.
Okay, great. Thank you. Leshin, thanks for joining us on the Indi Candidates Forum.
Thank you, Ben.